Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we continue our conversations about International Women's Day today. And the battle in this country now is about reproductive rights taking place in front of the Supreme Court. We are joined once again by Danny McLean, who is contributing writer for The Nation and fellow at the Nation Institute, focusing on race and reproductive justice. Danny, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. And Zoe Carpenter joins us as well, The Nation's associate Washington editor who's been covering the Supreme Court and all these cases. And Zoe, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, comment on the Mark Steiner Facebook page, send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. But do join us live if you can, 410-319-8888. So this case before the Supreme Court, Zoe, Women's Health versus V. Hellerstedt, is that right?
That's right.
Right? Let's just talk a bit about that case for a moment, and then I want to kind of get into a broader discussion about what's happened over the last 30 years or so around reproductive rights in America. But please give us a sense of what's happening here.
Sure. So the case was brought against the state of Texas for a couple of regulations on providers of abortion. So the two regulations at issue are one that requires doctors to have a professional affiliation with a hospital within 30 miles that lets them admit patients. And the other requirement is that clinics that perform abortions meet standards that are set out for ambulatory surgical centers, even if they don't provide surgical abortions and they only provide abortions by medication. And so the challenge is that this puts an undue burden on a woman's constitutional right to access abortion services. The Supreme Court heard it last week, and the arguments were really interesting. We had both the four liberal justices, especially the three female justices, really going hard at this claim that the law is a health and safety regulation, which is what the state of Texas says. And then on the other side, we had mostly Justice Alito, who was challenging the law and challenging the idea that these regulations would actually shut down clinics and hinder access.
So, and the consequence of this, I mean, we have it. If this is an 8-8, let's take two scenarios here. I mean, A, if this was an 8-8 tie come June, a 4-4 tie, excuse me, come June, that means that law in Texas would stand, right?
That's correct. The law would stand. It wouldn't set a precedent for the rest of the country, which is what some abortion rights supporters had feared the Supreme Court might do before the death of Scalia. If Justice Kennedy sides with the four more liberal justices and says that this law is unconstitutional, then the law would be struck down, and that would be a serious blow to this tactic that the right has advanced, which is basically trying to regulate abortion providers out of existence.
One of the things, what you just said, I was thinking about the last sentence you just said, Zoe, Danny, I mean, that is... I mean, people, I don't know how many people are really aware of the depth of the struggle happening in the United States around the question of reproductive rights, what it has meant for especially women in certain states in the United States, throughout the South and some of the Western states. I mean, this has been an onslaught going on for like 30 years now, 40 years.
Right. I mean, the two restrictions that Zoe just explained, the hospital admitting privileges, the requirement that providers have hospital admitting privileges, and the ambulatory surgical center requirements. I mean, so we're seeing how that's playing out in Texas, but these are among the requirements that have been passed on the state level in other states as well across the country. Some of these other restrictions that have passed at the state level include a 72-hour waiting period requiring that a woman seeking an abortion have an initial, you know, conversation with the doctor, wait 3 days, and then have to return to actually get the procedure, which for a woman who has to travel great distances to reach a clinic, obviously that could be quite inconvenient and in some cases very expensive if you're, you know, thinking about paying for a hotel room overnight. There are all these new laws that are banning abortion before a certain period of time, sometimes as early as 6 weeks, which is often a woman doesn't even know if she's pregnant at 6 weeks. So, you know, this is really part of a national wave that is, I think, attempting to do exactly what Zoe said, which is to legislate abortion out of existence. And I think what we're seeing is What is interesting to me, at least, is, this is really a question about how to keep abortion safe and legal. People will figure out means to not carry a pregnancy to term if that's what they feel that they need to do because of their own often economic situations. And so, what are people going to do if their access to a safe and legal abortion is restricted? They will still find other ways to terminate pregnancies.
There was an interesting, a frightening article actually in the New York Times on March the 5th. That people searching the internet for do-it-yourself
right.
abortions, DIY abortions, and that wherever abortions are being restricted in America is where these the internet has been slammed, hundreds of thousands of people looking for ways to do it yourself.
Yep, exactly. The state with the highest search rate, people doing online searches, figuring out how to self-induce abortion was Mississippi, which unsurprisingly, has one remaining clinic as a result of the laws that have been passed limiting access. And that article also points out that in 2011, online searches for how to self-induce abortion jumped 40%. And that was a year when, a lot of these state legislatures had already passed, but, began enacting these restrictive provisions. That year, 92 provisions restricting access were enacted. So that's exactly, I think that's exactly right. And that's something that we need to pay attention to and be concerned about.
I mean, Zoe, when you look at the map of America and see where the states that are most restrictive around abortion, it's 20 odd states, many in the South, not all in the South. I mean, everything from Utah and Arizona to the Dakotas to Nebraska, Iowa, Oklahoma, Missouri, Arkansas, all through the old Confederacy, Ohio, Indiana, and Wisconsin. I mean, this is I look at this, and I was also looking at the electoral map, but I find it very – there's an overlay you can do here that is a pretty interesting and in some ways frightening scenario.
Yeah, I think the overlay that you're mentioning is that these are largely states that are controlled by Republican and conservative Republican state legislatures. I think what's interesting and the reason we're seeing these laws passed, and even in states that aren't totally deep red, in some purple states as well, is that they're framed in a way that makes these laws seem pretty innocuous. For people who don't understand, how they're conducted, things like that, it sounds pretty reasonable to say, oh, we want this facility to meet medical standards, to meet surgical standards. It's been, unfortunately, pretty easy for anti-abortion activists to talk about these laws in benign health and safety terms. And who doesn't want, which pro-choice activists don't want abortion to be safe? But the point is that actually these laws make it less safe because it makes it harder to get. It forces women to wait until later in their pregnancy and more expensive. And so they may delay longer or they may search out other options, as Danny was saying, not safe options, the so-called back alley abortions or self-induced abortions.
Again, when you folks, I do want to encourage you all to join. By the way, start there at 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on this? This is a major case, even though we know it will not decide for America. There is a trend going on here around these battles, and it's been moved to the states. And politically, Danny, what does that mean? I mean, for reproductive rights to be moved to a state battle, that's what's happened, I think, in the last 40 years. There was when Roe v. Wade happened, it became people assumed the law of the land, that a woman had a right to choose. Mm. And that's been whittled away. And now it's become, again, this age-old American political battle over, quote-unquote, states' rights versus federal laws protecting civil rights. But and that's what's happening in this case. I mean, looking at this map, I'm just you can see where it's happening.
Yeah, I think one of the things that it has meant is that we've seen the creation and mobilization of some pretty incredible organizations that focus on state and regional work in order to preserve access to reproductive health and abortion more specifically. So, one of the there was a great article in the New York Times Well, the article was, I don't know if the article was great, but I was very interested to see that in the New York Times coverage of protests that were happening outside of the Supreme Court during the hearings, this particular article quoted a young black woman, I think she was 24, who had gone to DC from Louisiana, where she works in New Orleans with a group called Women with a Vision, which is a group that focuses specifically on black women. It's a black women's reproductive justice organization. And I think we can, point to groups like Sister Reach in Tennessee, New Voices Pittsburgh. There are groups in California, Ohio. I mean, every state where there is some kind of battle happening around abortion rights, and more broadly, battles related to reproductive justice, whether it's, improving sex ed, preserving and broadening access to contraception, what any kind of way that these fights take shape, anywhere that there's a struggle happening, you see organizations that are working to build a base and educate community members about what's at stake and try to mobilize people to lobby their legislators so that they weigh in on these issues in ways that work for women and families.
Zoe, do you want to add to that before you open the phones here?
Yeah. Oh, I just wanted to chime onto that. I think one of the consequences of these laws is not just about abortion access, because abortion happens within the context of a whole range of other reproductive services.
Right.
And this idea of reproductive justice is really important, because it's not just a woman's right to end a pregnancy. It's a woman's right to have a child if she chooses to do so, and to do that with the health support that she needs that in a safe and healthy way. And so it's not really a surprise that many of the states that have some of the most restrictive anti-abortion laws also have some of the worst outcomes in terms of maternal and neonatal health.
And that is the hidden part of the battle people do not want to engage in often, I think. But let me engage our listeners here at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Dana McLean and Zoe Carpenter about the cases before the Supreme Court and the continuing battle around women's reproductive rights and in this country. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Donna. You're on the air. Welcome. Good morning, Donna.
Hello.
Good morning, Donna.
Hello.
You're on the air, Donna. Good morning.
Hi, my name is not Donna, it's Lolita.
Lolita, I'm sorry, I had Donna on my screen. Sorry.
There's a whole lot that I don't know about this issue, but I was sitting here thinking, what happens if a woman has a self-induced abortion and she ends up in crisis and needing medical care? Is that woman criminalized because she's in a state that has banned and restricted abortion, and now she's self-induced an abortion and she needs medical care?
That's such a great question.
That's a great question. Do you want to jump in that, Danny?
Yeah, I mean, that is such a critical question. And I think, so what we're seeing is, alongside of these restrictions on abortion, we're seeing a proliferation of, sometimes they're called fetal assault bills. These laws, that's what it's called in Tennessee, at least, where we've seen this really take root. These are bills that, I'm sorry, these are laws that do exactly what Lolita just said. They criminalize women who have done something that, a healthcare provider deems, was meant to harm their fetus. So sometimes it's just that a woman has miscarried, and there's something about the miscarriage that triggers the healthcare provider to involve law enforcement. The healthcare provider might think that the woman has tried to induce abortion, but that's actually not what happened. In other cases, there was a case of a young woman in Georgia, I think this was last year, where, yeah, she had in fact, I believe, taken a pill in an effort to induce an abortion, and she was criminalized. I think the charges were eventually dropped, but it's bringing about this this real quandary for someone who can't terminate their pregnancy legally. how do you do it when you then run the risk of being criminalized for trying to do it yourself? So this is something that is really being, like I said, it's a very hot topic in Tennessee specifically, but there are other states where this is the case of Purvi Patel, a woman in Indiana who was criminalized, and she's facing 20 years in prison.
She's now facing 20 years in prison?
Yes, she's facing 20 years in prison for... yes, attempting to self-induce abortion. And, you know, she's, I think the charge was criminal endangerment of a child. I think that for some reason, the prosecutor, you know, is making this argument that the child was delivered. I'm sorry, you know, that this pregnancy actually was carried to term. But so we're seeing these cases crop up all over the country, and they're quite, quite complicated and quite devastating.
In Indiana, Zoe, as I was looking again, is what I was reading this morning, is one of the most restrictive states in the country.
Right, and we don't think of that as being one of those red southern states. So
right.
Back to your earlier point that the map is really quite varied. The one interesting thing I'll say quickly about those fetal assault laws is that, again, many of them are framed as health and safety measures. The Tennessee law specifically criminalizes opioid use.
Right.
And so... this, on the surface, it seems to have nothing to do with abortion, and of course, we know that women should not use drugs while they're pregnant. But if you look deeper at the ideology underlying the law, which is that a woman should be responsible for the outcome of her pregnancy and should be criminally liable for it, that's creating a legal structure that has really serious implications for reproductive rights.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to where we think this battle America is going. I mean, it's define a little bit of that for our future. But let me go back to the phones of 410-319-8888. Donna, welcome. You're on the air.
How you doing, Mark?
Very well. Good morning.
Excellent show.
Thank you.
Donna,
we lost you. Call right back. We'll get you. I don't know what happened. That might have been a glitch on our part. Whosever part it was, we'll get you right back on at 410-319-8888. So let me come back to the question. This, you know, we're looking, as I look at this presidential campaign and as we look at all the issues really dividing America in some really deep fundamental ways on race, on the future of our economy, on numbers of issues, on the environment. But this reproductive rights issue is a very complex one. You know, Dan, you've been on the show numerous times where there have been debates on whether or not it's genocide against people of color. And that's come up as well. But this is a fundamental issue here that I think is really tearing at America. And I just talk a bit about both of you. Let me start with you, Danny. Just what politically and socially you think is happening here, and what may be happening over the next 10, 20 years.
Well, I think that. A constitutionally, you know, a protected right that we thought, you know, perhaps many thought could be taken for granted, is up against a pretty, as Zoe explained, a pretty well thought out and orchestrated national attack on abortion rights. That has gained a lot of traction in recent years. And, you know, one thing I often say, Mark, when I'm on your show is that all I can do is look to the energy that I see coming from, as I mentioned, reproductive justice organizations who are trying to push back and who are trying to, you know, educate their neighbors and people in their communities about how to counter these really dangerous messages, to try to counter the stigma that's been placed on abortion. I mean, one of the issues is that 1 in 3 women has had an abortion, yet there's such a great stigma, and then very few people talk about it, kind of come out of the closet and say, this is nothing to be ashamed of. I'm not going to let these politicians, you know, make me feel as if I've done something wrong. This is my, you know, I have a right to access this form of health care. There's a real effort to try to get people to speak out and to tell the truth about their own histories as they relate to abortion. abortion. So, you know, I just look to the efforts of people who are trying to educate the public, trying to organize themselves and each other to push back against the spread of these laws.
So you want to jump in? I'm going to go back to our phones here, but I want to get your thoughts on that.
Sure. I think one thing that I found really interesting recently was there was some polling done about Donald Trump supporters. And one thing this poll found is there's actually about 30% of Republican voters are moderate, and many of them are actually pro-choice and support Planned Parenthood. And I found that surprising because the Republican candidates and lawmakers in Congress tend to be so extreme on abortion and birth control and a whole manner of other things related to reproductive health. But there is actually a large swath of the party that has accepted the sexual revolution, both in terms of gay marriage and in terms of some level of support for legal abortion. So I think that's actually encouraging in some ways, but then the question becomes one of messaging and exposing these underhanded supposed health and safety tactics for what they really are. And I think that's what the reproductive rights movement has been focusing on many ways recently, and I think that's the sort of immediate challenge is for the people who do support legal abortion. You have to help them understand how these attacks aren't really just about health and safety; that they're really about eroding that right.
Let me return to the phones here. This whole thing's a working 410-319-8888. Donna, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Can you hear me now, Mark?
We got you, Donna.
Right. My question is, how far does the reproductive rights violate, assault against reproductive rights affect women and men who want to get sterilization, birth control usage, the morning after pill, and also what religious groups are behind this? Are they the evangelicals, the Catholic Church who's been strong against it, or whatever? So what, and then what faces does this assault affect mostly women of color or just poor women, period? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Really good question. Dan, let me go to you first, if I might.
Sure. There were many questions there. I mean, I think one thing that's, and they're all really excellent, so I'm trying to remember. I mean, the one, Donna's final question about, whether women of color are being disproportionately impacted by these restrictions. The answer is yes. So obviously there's often, an overlap between low-income, people who are low-income and people of color. If you're in Texas, for example, almost 40%, actually 46% of women who are of reproductive age are Latina. So there are 2.5 million Latinas of reproductive age in Texas. And one thing that's been pointed out repeatedly is if you look at the closures, the clinic closures, as a result of HB2, I think at this point there is either one or no clinic left in the Rio Grande Valley. So, right. Right along the border, which has made it incredibly difficult for, I think there is still.
Did we just lose Danny? Something happened. We get Danny back. Zoe, you want to pick up? I'm sorry.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'll address the question about which groups are pushing these kinds of laws. It is evangelical groups, and the Catholic Church has maintained its opposition to abortion and birth control. I don't think that they're necessarily the most active group on the ground. There are lots of specific groups like Americans United for Life, and that group AUL. AUL, sorry. They were kind of some of the pioneers at adopting this language of health and safety to shroud the intention, essentially erode Roe v. Wade. So Americans United for Life initially formed 2 years before Roe v. Wade decision and then spent most of its early two decades fighting to overturn that Supreme Court ruling. they weren't successful at doing that in a direct way. So then we see this transition to the incremental tactics that are framed as health and safety regulations.
Danny, are you back?
I am. I was just talking away, so I'm not exactly sure where I fell off. But, I was just talking about, you know, in Texas that...
The Rio Grande is where I think we lost you.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, you know, there are a number of kind of intersecting issues here where you have people who might have some restraints on their mobility because they're undocumented. And so traveling 4 hours to reach the nearest abortion provider means going through, ICE checkpoints, which are border control checkpoints, which is difficult, immigration checkpoints, I should say. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are these ways in which these restrictions are putting people who are already in vulnerable positions because of their race, because of their socioeconomic status, because of their immigration status, in even more vulnerable positions. So, yes, I think that that this question of kind of, you know, intersecting identities and how these restrictions are affecting low-income women of color is incredibly important.
Do you either one of you think it's fair? I was thinking about this. I was reading Katha Pollitt's piece in The Nation the other day and also going back and forth with her by email for a minute, that the people who believe in reproductive rights for women, the part of the problem is that Democrats and others not being able to stand up and say the word abortion, not being able to fight for it openly. People are afraid to do it. Do you think that's a fair argument to make?
I'll jump in there.
Go ahead, Zoe.
I do think it has been fair in the past, you know, couple of decades, certainly. But we've seen sort of a change in that. For example, Hillary Clinton used to talk about abortion being safe, legal, and rare, and that sort of phrasing fits into this argument that it's okay to regulate it almost out of existence so long as it's technically still legal. But now we hear a really different kind of tone coming from many, particularly female Democrats. I think there's still work to be done on that front. But as Danny has pointed out, that there are so many really great organizations that are working to shake stigma and to go way beyond just saying the word abortion. And I think that is really having an impact, especially for a younger generation of women who don't remember a time when abortion was illegal.
And final thought.
Yeah. I mean, just what I think one thing that shows the shift that Zoe just pointed out is, you know, both Clinton and Sanders have committed to repealing the Hyde Amendment, which is the ban on Medicaid coverage of abortions, which basically excludes poor women from having access and being able to have that procedure covered by Medicaid. So, I mean, that's a huge step for these Democratic presidential candidates to make while they're campaigning. And it's a huge shift from exactly, you know, Clinton calling, you know, using words like tragic and rare to describe abortion in the past.
It's always a pleasure to have the two of you. You're both so insightful. Dan McLean, contributing writer for The Nation, fellow of The Nation's, to where she's focusing on race and reproductive justice, and Zoe Carpenter, The Nation's associate Washington editor, who's been following very closely what's happening in the Supreme Court. Thank you both so much for joining us here on International Women's Day.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be wrestling with the issues of race and class in this presidential election, the complexities therein. Stay with us. We'll be right back.